Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable Chief Justice David Wilkerson presiding, is now in session.
Please be seated. This is the time and the place set for the annual rules hearing of the South Dakota Supreme Court. The record may show that due notice was given to the bar and the public by publication of these proposed rules in the State Bar Newsletter and also posted on our webpage. Although the rules of the court require that for people to speak, they file in advance with the clerk a written copy of what they intend to say. We've been very liberal in the past and allowed anybody to speak that really wishes to do so, whether they've filed anything or not. We'll proceed in the same order that the notices have the proposed rules, and if anybody wishes to speak, just come on up to the podium. Rule number one proposed would be an adoption of a rule designated as 15-628A, Interstate Depositions and Discovery, proposed by Gene LeBrun and Representative David Luss, both members of the South Dakota Bar. Are there any proponents of this rule? If not, are there any opponents? Okay. Rule number two, the proposal would be in a matter of adoption of a new rule taking discovery and declarations in foreign countries. This has also been proposed by Mr. LeBrun and Representative Lust. Any proponents on this one? Any opponents? Rule number three would amend SDCL 16-16-17.1, the conditional admission rule. This has been proposed by the bar examiners. Are there any proponents? Ms. Sabers. You're noisy. That's the sign on the gates.
I apologize for starting there.
Kind of noisy.
Good morning. I don't actually have any prepared comments. I would like to tell you a little bit about what our plan was with the proposal, but mainly I'm here to answer any questions you may have. Under 17.1, we have a problem with the language, and we'd like to clarify it. Right now, it says that my board can propose a conditional admission if we find unresolved issues of good moral character and fitness. But yet, 16.2.2 says that the applicant at all times bears the burden to prove good moral character and fitness. And it's a difficult standard to reconcile. On one hand, it says you don't get past the hump of bar admission unless you've proven your good moral character. And yet our conditional admission statute says if the Board of Bar Examiners wants to lower the standard, we can. We don't think lowering the standard is the way to go, and most states that have adopted conditional admission are actually tightening the standards and narrowing the class of people to which it applies. We'd like to correct what we think is simply a language flaw. We would like to delete the language that says we can bypass unresolved issues of good moral character. Delete that altogether and simply propose it in different ways to say, if the applicant does indeed show good moral character, they bear that burden. If they meet that burden, we can still impose a conditional admission for a few reasons. We would no longer use it as a bar-lowering mechanism, but instead as a bar-raising mechanism. We think an applicant has gotten over the obstacle of good moral character, but we continue to believe that the general public may be better protected if we had a few strings attached before completely broad and unconditioned licensure was warranted and rewarded by this court. So that's the main change in 17.1. We would delete that language. The other one, perhaps of more interest to this court, right now in 17.1 it says that you as the Supreme Court may accept or reject the recommendation. in all fairness, I think you can do whatever you'd like to do with our recommendations. I think if you would like to modify, for instance, that's certainly within your power. So in our proposed changes, we actually added in the word modify. Right now, according to the rule, you reject or accept. So if you wanted to modify, you would presumably then reject, send it back down to us to rework it, and send it back up your way. We think that an unnecessary step, when in the end, the decision on all of these applicants ultimately rests with this court. So in our proposal, in addition to striking the unresolved character issue language, we're adding in the verb modify to more specifically clarify this court's role. Chief, did you have a question? Sorry. No?
No, I didn't.
Okay. Under the next section, which is 17.2, really we're just going on to, again, expand or expound upon what we believe our role to be. In the fourth fine bound, we say, conditional admission is neither a means to achieve good moral character, meaning if you don't have the evidence of rehabilitation or standalone good moral character, we're not supposed to be using conditional admission to let you into the bar. If you can't get there on your own, conditional admission does not supplant your burden to prove that. It goes on to say, though, that we're not supposed to err on the other side either. It says it should not be a method of monitoring the behavior of all applicants. In other words, if we think 50 applicants get over the hump of moral character and fitness, but we think, oh, wouldn't it be fun to attach a few strings to these folks and watch them for a little while longer? This rule cautions us not to do that either. So we shouldn't use it to lower or significantly raise. Again, the burden on these applicants is to establish good moral character. If they do that, then it's up to us and this court to decide whether additional conditions are warranted. The next two sections, 17.3 and 17.4,
Can I ask a question before you?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm interested in the language of the last sentence in 17.2, where you say conditional admission may be employed only when an applicant has been engaged in a sustained. I'm not sure what is the purpose behind that sentence?
Let's say an applicant comes before the board with significant child support arrearages and pays them off the day before the hearing. Is that a period of sustained remediation and rehabilitation? Probably not. Maybe Justice Konenkamp, he used all of his available funds, funneled those towards arrearages, and 30 days from now he's behind on his rent and other child support obligations, etc. Or we have a recovering alcoholic or a substance abuser who's been in rehab for 2 weeks, 3 weeks. They can't claim they've been dry for 6 months, but they can claim they've been dry for 6 weeks, 6 days. We did not define what period of time sufficient means, and we would leave that in part up to the board and in part up to this court, but we'd like to see some length of time. We did not specifically put a length of time in there because we think, frankly, it's a sliding scale. In some cases, a short period of rehabilitation may be good enough to satisfy the board's concerns, and in others it would not be. So we'd like to see a length of time either where the drug and substance abuse is beyond, behind, and under control, or even in the area of mental health, which we're seeing more and more of. Maybe they've been on medication and they've been kind of going down the straight path for a little while longer.
I wonder if that sentence maybe you should go in another paragraph, because it seems to contradict the first sentence that says conditional admission may be employed to permit, et cetera, et cetera. And then it says in your last sentence may only be may be employed only when an applicant. It seems like to me what you're trying to say is that in cases where rehabilitation is an issue, conditional admission may be employed only. You know, I wonder if you. I'm just wondering about the language.
And I think that those are all fair comments, and I think those are all good comments and good suggestions. It may be better placed if we moved it back to 17.1, and it may be better placed, frankly, if we move it down under 17.3, where we specifically discuss the length of time. In 17.3 sub C, We say, again, this sufficient period of time, Your Honor. So, Justice Konenkamp, I would say that sentence may be better if we excise it from 17.2 and put it down under sub C in 17.3.
I have a comment, maybe more than a question, on 17.1. That last paragraph says that you are to keep matters confidential except to advise the Secretary Treasurer of the State Bar. I wouldn't wonder if it wouldn't be more appropriate to advise the Disciplinary Board.
The way these, and actually, Chief, that language stayed the same. Even though we show it as a red
right.
line, that language is consistent.
I'm trying to keep him out of trouble if he goes and tells the Disciplinary Board, which is obviously what he would do.
How we've handled these so far, and the few that have come back to us, when these folks are still under a conditional admission period, they've come to our board first, and we have dealt with them either to recommend a revocation of the conditional admission or to go on about. I have not seen the double referral yet, Your Honor, and maybe it's because the disciplinary proceedings are confidential. So I'm not sure how those two work together, but it may make sense to make both aware.
Well, I guess what I'm trying to bring up is, do you see right now under the current system, if this is in place, that given the confidentiality of both your board and the disciplinary board, is there sufficient communication between the two boards so somebody doesn't slip through the cracks here? And maybe this is for another day.
And I don't think I can answer that because I don't know who has and who has not come in front of the disciplinary board. So I don't think I have those facts, Your Honor. There could be a person slipping through the cracks. I think that Tom Barnett, our current Secretary Treasurer, is involved at the disciplinary level much more so than at our level, but I don't know how that would work if it would get cross-referred back to my board if it did come in front of the disciplinary
board.
He
is the secretary to the disciplinary board
yes.
also. But I just, my only concern was you've got two boards of confidentiality, and I didn't want a situation where you can't talk to each other, and the result is somebody slips through the cracks.
Another good point. This is a work in progress. I think this has remained changed and in place since 96 when it first came in. I think that a move to include the disciplinary board would be helpful because then we will know if one of our own on conditional admit happens to go their way and we're not aware of that, it would be much better if both of us were aware of it at the same time.
And we would probably have to look at the disciplinary board rules to fix theirs at the same time so they can talk back to you.
Might have to.
I guess this is for another day, so go. Anybody else got any questions or comments?
I don't know if you were done with discussing the rules, but in 17.3, I just noticed that you have a definite amount of time for the financial rehabilitation and not a definite time for the others. Isn't there a sliding scale?
It's interesting, and I think it's an arbitrary six-month period. This is a copy of that portion of the rule from Illinois. Florida and California also follow that rule. What we hear at the seminars we attend on character and fitness is debt is coming at us more and more. These kids are coming out of law school with these huge debts that just hang over them for forever. But more and more what we're seeing is it's easier for those folks to try to clean that up and have it look good. Maybe they can look good on the day of their hearing, but maybe they don't look so good the next day, like I was saying over here. They may funnel funds to take care of one debt that they're worried may cause the most concern to the Board of Bar Examiners, yet the rest of their debts fall apart. So it's certainly, you can strike the six. Certainly you have that power to do so. And I would not have any objection to striking the six. We were really following the lead of the other states that have said, minimally, we'd like to see you clean this up and fix some of these debt issues and stay on track for at least 6 months.
So it's easier to put a time limit on that and know that you're okay as opposed to substance abuse or mental health issues.
In our view, it is, and certainly that's what we've seen. Folks either get on the right path there or not, but they need some time to do so. We have seen applicants with significant substance abuse problems that I would have been comfortable letting in the next day and comfortable not letting in 6 years. So it is arbitrary, and if the court would like to strike it, certainly feel free to, especially if we're taking Justice Konenkamp's concern from 17.2 about the sufficient period of time, we could simply put that down in 17.3 and strike the six-month requirement on the debt.
Thank you.
Other questions for Ms. Sabers? As long as you're here, this is maybe collateral to the rules, but what trends is the board seeing as far as conditional admissions? What you've already referenced debt, and we know that's a biggie out there, but we've got, you know, other issues, drug abuse, domestic relations, alcohol abuse, maybe cheating in school. Reading the tea leaves, where do you think we're heading?
I think our three biggest issues are debt, mental health, and just general candor and honesty. I think those are the three things we struggle with most often. What I'm pleased to say is we rarely have these students come back on conditional admit. So the students that we're giving a chance on the conditional admit, we're not seeing many of them come back our way. I think we have two or three coming up this month where we're going to recommend unconditioned admission.
I just signed one yesterday.
There you go. And I think there are several more coming your way. The debt is skyrocketing. And we've seen at the national level where law schools are actually being sued for supposed fraud in their marketing and in their employment statistics. So I think debt is coming. We've struggled with the mental health issue. We have some questions on the application that are actually drafted by the National Conference that say if you, and we've seen this in an appeal to this court, if you have a mental health issue that, if left untreated, could somehow in any way affect your license or your ability to practice law, please let us know. But what we've seen is some of the applicants have said, well, I'm treating it, so I don't have to tell you about it. Well, that's not what the question is asking. So what we've done is Ms. Anderson and I have revamped our own question, and we've actually put an additional question or two into the South Dakota portion of the application that says, hey, we really mean it. We want to know about it. We're seeing more and more of these students come through on antidepressants. That's not a huge concern. They're treating, they're in supportive treatment, and they're doing well. It's the kids who aren't in treatment, or it's the kids who are ending up in the hospital for nervous breakdowns the week before law school exams. Those are the situations that cause us the biggest concern. And then the other issue, Chief, is the candor. We have some students who would come before us, and they wouldn't admit that the sun rises and sets on a daily basis. And there's little we can do with that. And if you'll notice, when we're proposing limiting the conditional admission, we're not proposing that if you lack candor, somehow that makes you worthy of a conditional admit. That's one of the big ones that we really struggle with, and we don't think there's no good condition to place upon that licensure that would get us around and satisfy our concerns on the lack of candor.
One other thought, as long as we have you here. And I'm sure you're fully aware that there is a move nationally to go to a national bar exam. I don't go to a national conference, but what that does not come up. Some of our neighboring states have gone to it. Since this is a public arena, are you comfortable in telling us what your board's position is on a national bar exam and why?
I am, absolutely, Your Honor. And I'll be in Phoenix tomorrow with the National Conference of Bar Examiners, and they'll be putting the push on again for the Uniform Bar Exam. We're a small state with a small number of applicants, comparatively speaking, to other states. It gives us less power, if you will, in comparison with the larger states that will adopt the Uniform Bar Exam. If we don't like a certain topic on the bar exam right now, my board is given 8 essay exam questions to choose from every time we administer the exam. That's up to my board to determine which questions they'd like to give. We used to pick 6 of the 8. Now we pick 5 of the 8, and then our number 6 is our Indian law question. If we adapted the Uniform Bar Exam, our Indian law question would be gone. It's something we're proud of. It's something we believe is working well. I think if you ask Professor Pommersheim down at the law school, he'd say his numbers in Indian law have skyrocketed. And that alone, I think, is a huge success. Even if we improve at a basic level a student's knowledge of Indian law when they're going to practice in this state or elsewhere, it's perfect. It's a step in the right direction. Indian law would be gone. So too would my board's ability to pick among the questions. We would now be given 6 questions, and there would be no selection process. We would be forced with those. Also, the grading of the exam itself would now be set by national standards as well. As a general rule, my board, I would tell you, follows the recommendations of the National Conference as a general rule. But when it comes down to it, if we see a question and we don't at all agree with either the suggested answer or the suggested weighting of that answer, my board can fix that. We can say, hey, that's not the law in South Dakota, or we don't think that's the practical rule. We think that's too philosophical and not practical enough. Whatever may be the reason, it's up to our board to grade that question accordingly. That autonomy in our grading process and in our selection of question process would be out the window. The final point, the uniform bar exam in our board's view would have made a lot more sense 100 years ago. In the world of reciprocity, when I have a Minnesota license and I can go get an Iowa license if I want one, in the world of reciprocity where people are crossing borders and sharing licensure in other states, the uniform bar exam does not seem to me to be as important as it once was, because people are accepting other states' grades. They are accepting other states' applicants. So the thought behind the UBE is that we would wipe out these borders and people could kind of practice wherever they want. I like leaving that control in the state's hands. Minnesota, for instance, has a rather hefty CLE requirement. I have to take, I think, 45 hours of CLE every other year or I lose my Minnesota licensure. Minnesota thinks that's important and they can require that of me. When we take this step away to the UBE, we start talking about those individual states' rights or the state's requirements would start to disappear as we move towards this nationalized standard. Some of those things are very important on a state level, and I would submit that our Indian law question is one such example. So I, as a board, I can speak for the board. We have not been terribly supportive of that idea. We already give many of the standardized sections of the exam, so it is already a largely standardized test, but we've held back a little of that power and a little of that autonomy, and we think that's the better rule in the long run. We're not huge fans or on board yet. That is what I would say officially on behalf of the board.
Thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Savers from the court? Now, we've talked about some amendments today. Do you want to send in a copy? Should we have it done that way, Justices, about moving sections around in that? What's your wishes on that?
Would be more than willing to do so if that's what the court wanted.
You know, just one other thought. On 17.3, that first paragraph is very long, and then ends with this, "except that." And I, you know, my law clerk pointed this out to me, and I wonder if there's a way to break that down to make that more. It's a lot to swallow, you know. I wonder if there's a way if you could find a way to maybe break that down into two sentences. Might be easier to understand.
I have on my list to try to address the six-month concern of Justice Wilbur by using the language from 17.2 and perhaps dropping it down. I have also on my list to fix the first paragraph of 17.3 as best I can, which may simply be ignoring half of the words and shortening it, Your Honor. Any other suggestions or concerns?
You were going to move that one sentence, weren't you?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, I guess all right. Anything else from the court from Ms. Savers? If not, thank you for making the trip from Sioux Falls. We appreciate you coming.
Absolutely.
And thanks for your service on the board and the other members of the board. This is extra duty to do this, so we really appreciate it.
Well, we appreciate the appreciation because we don't necessarily get it from the folks who are in front of us. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right. So then we are at proposal number 7, which would amend SDCL 23A44-5.1. Time allowed for disposition of criminal cases. This was proposed by Presiding Judge Guinea from the Third Circuit. Anybody wish to speak in behalf of this proposal? If not, anybody wish to speak against it? All right, the next one would be proposal number 8, which would amend SDCL 25-4-58.1, minimum qualifications for family court mediators. This is proposed by Judge Hoffman from Sioux Falls. Does anybody wish to speak on behalf of this? If not, does anybody wish to speak against it? Number 9 is in the matter of adoption of a new rule to recognize electronic documents as official court records. This is proposed by the Supreme Court Administrator's Office. Does anybody wish to speak on this one? Mr. Sadlesack.
Chief Justice, members of the court. For the record, my name is Greg Satizan. I'm the legal counsel for the State Court Administrator's Office. This proposal was brought forth after it was studied by a committee consisting of Judges Davis, Judge Jensen, Judge Dietrich, three circuit court clerks, and then three members of the IT staff and also myself. What this is, as we move toward electronic documents, and I know you're all aware of the pilot project and Odyssey, what this does is, as documents come in, and this is happening now in those six pilot counties, when an attorney files a document, those documents are scanned into the system. And as of now, the hard copy, the paper version, is retained for 180 days. And that's because that kind of coincides with the pilot time period. But as of now, based on current law, the official record is still that paper file. Obviously, the entire point of proceeding with this project is to move toward electronic files. So this rule would do a few things. It would recognize the official record is the electronic record. The paper record is no longer the official record. And that there's a reason behind that. I know there may be some pushback from certain members in the court system about going to an electronic record. But by having a rule that says this is the court record, it would relieve a lot of pressure on clerk's office to kind of create duplicate records if someone maybe doesn't like looking at the electronic record. It also would recognize electronic signatures, and as this rule speaks, this is speaking to things that the court is doing and producing the documents kind of once arrived at the clerk's office, everything that happens behind the scenes. We're not yet ready for the electronic documents coming directly into the system. This would build the base, and so once the documents have been managed behind the scenes by the clerks, as documents can be plugged in from attorneys through e-filing and members of the public, everything won't be new to the clerks. They'll know how to deal with electronic documents. They'll know how to transmit them. They'll know how to attach a judge's signature to make an electronic record, how to create the official court record. And then it also addresses public access. Just because the documents are electronic doesn't mean that the public access is diminished in any means. And so that has to be dealt with. There are a number of ways of doing that. It can be through things like a public terminal that provides access to the court's records. Obviously, the clerk of court is not going to just say, I have that on my computer here, come take a look. So we have to provide that access in a reasonable way to the public. It could be through the creation of portals. It may be when an attorney needs to check out a file that a flash drive or a USB device could be created that creates that court record. And so there's a number of things that need to be addressed, and this is sort of the backbone for that. And the way it's drafted, it really creates the broad scope of what the general idea is in the official record. And then the State Court Administrator, in consultation with the Technology Council, would have the authority under the rule to create the sort of day-to-day policy. And I mentioned 180 days on saving paper documents. As everyone becomes more familiar with the system, that number should dramatically decrease. In most states, the paper comes in, the clerk scans it, verifies it's easily readable, retrievable, it exists, and then the paper document goes away. And so having those stick around for so long just doesn't make sense. That's kind of what we're moving away from. But obviously, we're not ready to just say 3 days, 2 days, 7 days, quite yet. And so this would vest authority with the State Court Administrator to kind of make the policy adjust as the technology becomes more spread across the state and as familiarity is kind of more ingrained in how things are done. It also would allow the Court Administrator to address very technical things that probably, I'm guessing, the court does not want to have to deal with every 6 months, things like dots per inch of the scanned item. How many pages can be scanned in at a time for clerks in order to ensure retrievability? And some of those very technical day-to-day issues. And that idea is not new to the court system. That's what sort of was done when the judicial accounting system came online and the JAS manual was created and those rules of accounting procedure. Those were vested with the State Court Administrator to deal with those on a day-to-day basis. And we borrowed from that theory in developing these rules. night. We'll just mention that these rules have been, they were drafted by the committee, reviewed by court administration, reviewed by the presiding judges, and also reviewed by the technology council, and they're all in support of those, of the provisions. So with that, I'd certainly stand by for any questions you may have.
Any questions for Mr. Satterthwaite?
I have a question. Can you explain a little bit in Section 5 about the in the signature section about what it means? It says the submission of a document signed with a slash signature or electronic image of the traditional signature when filed, and this is the part I'm interested in, with the login and password of a judge. What is that? How will that work?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Justice Wilbur. The way, what's that envisioned is really the signature, we all like the big, the blue ink signature, and that's a psychological thing that we don't want to give up. And so a lot of judges will want their actual signature attached to a document, and or they may just, I think you probably have seen, this is very common in the PACER federal system, the S slash and then the printed name. So those would still exist, so someone can see something and see that signature, but to attach that, for instance, you as a judge would have to enter your user ID and have a password to be able to attach that. Just obviously with a handwritten signature, it's guarded by the fact that it's your hand that's writing it. This guards the electronic image from being attached if it should not otherwise be attached.
So that's what lets me sign it, and that the login and the password don't show up on the document.
Exactly. So,
perfect.
Yep.
All right. Thank you.
Other questions for Mr. Satterthwaite? If not, thank you for the explanation, and thanks to your committee for all its fine work.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Anybody else wish to speak on this proposal? You law clerks, this is your chance. Get up to the podium. You've been waiting all these time. Okay. With that, we're in recess. Thank you all for coming. Till 10 o'clock, and we have an hour.